one cannot understand Tom Sowell without understanding the role that courage plays in his writing and speaking. Affirmative action hurts blacks. That's a truth. It's not an opinion. It's not a feeling. Blacks deserve affirmative action, but it is bad for them. So the essence of soul is truth telling. And the essence of the university and the whole left world, the left, not liberals, liberals are naive, but the left is rooted in lies. If the day you decide to pursue truth, you leave the left. You can be a liberal, you can be a conservative, but you can't be what is dominant, and that is left. People want to believe that human nature is basically good. It's an extremely dangerous and foolish idea. One side wants the other side dead. Once again, Tom Sowell understands this better than 99% of the professors of Middle Eastern history. They want to believe that, oh, if only Israel were more forthcoming, peace would reign in the Middle East. And there isn't a shred of evidence for that to be true. Not a shred. When Jews abandon belief that the Torah is from God, or at least the Ten Commandments, then they open themselves up to believing anything. When people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. So for Jews, it's either Judaism or you name the ism, Marxism, socialism, environmentalism, feminism. Jews, I always say, are the most religious people in the world, but for most of them, their religion is not Judaism.
Welcome to the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. I'm your host, Alan Wolin. The music you are hearing is the Israeli national anthem, and it's called Hatikva, which means the hope. I hope you will agree with me, whatever your political persuasion, that this song is hauntingly beautiful and is one of the world's best national anthems. The song is a poem about the Jewish people's longing for a homeland of their own. Here are the lyrics in English. As long as within our hearts the Jewish soul sings, as long as forward to the east, to Zion looks the eye, our hope is not yet lost. It is 2,000 years old. To be a free people in our land, the land of Zion and Jerusalem. I'd like to make Hatikva the theme music for this episode, and I'll play different versions of the song between the sections of the show. Later in the podcast, I will also play the Palestinian national anthem so we can contrast the two anthems. If you don't recognize the voice you heard in the introduction, you're in for a real treat today. Allow me to introduce you to the one and only Dennis Prager. If you already know Dennis Prager, you're also in for a treat today because he and I talk about Thomas Sowell and Sowell's views on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Dennis was scheduled to come on the podcast several weeks ago, before Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, 2023. I had planned to talk with him about Thomas Sowell in general, but given the outbreak of war between Israel and Hamas, it seemed appropriate to switch gears and focus on this theme. To prepare for my conversation with Dennis, I dug up my copy of Sowell's 1996 book, Migrations and Cultures, A World View. In that book, Sowell has a fascinating chapter called The Jews of the Diaspora. Luckily, this full chapter from the audiobook is available free on YouTube, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes so you can listen if you're interested in taking a deep dive into the history of the Jews. Here's one passage to whet your appetite.
Each of the numerous groups in the Roman Empire was expected to respect the rights of others, the gods of others, and to pay homage both to the political rulers and to the gods of Rome. Otherwise, they were free to pursue their own religion and their own way of life. Jews had a special difficulty in fitting into this Roman scheme. While other peoples had their own gods for themselves, the God of the Jews was conceived as the one God of all mankind and of the universe. While this might, in one sense, suggest the brotherhood of man, in another sense, it led to the conclusion that all other religions were false, that it was a sacrilege to accept them in any way, much less pay even formal homage to them. It was this feature of Judaism, and later Christianity, that provoked special political problems for the Jews, and later the Christians, in the Roman Empire. This view was also characteristic of the third great religion of the Middle East, Islam, which emerged in a still later era. Pagans were not intolerant of other religions. It was the Judeo-Christian tradition that introduced religious intolerance into the Roman Empire, and through it, into Western civilization. Over the ensuing centuries, no one suffered more as a result than the Jews.
Okay, you twisted my arm. Here's another clip from Migrations and Cultures.
Despite their use of religious intolerance to stir public feeling against the Jews, various attacks, expulsions, and confiscations had pragmatic goals, including being rid of creditors and the debts owed to them. When King Philip of France expelled the Jews in 1306, the reason given was that they charged excessively high interest rates. However, he did not cancel the debts owed to Jews, but instead set about collecting them for his own treasury. To his disappointment, the king discovered that the money collected in this way was less than the taxes that Jews had been paying. Moreover, when Christian moneylenders replaced Jews, complaints arose that Christians charged higher interest rates than the Jews had. The net result was that the Jews were invited back.
I also looked up what Sowell had to say on the subject of the Israeli-Arab conflicts, and I found two columns he had written. One was published in 2006, and the other in 2014. I would like to play those two columns for you today, so you have a clear understanding of where Sowell stands on this conflict. The first column, published in 2006, is called "There Is No Middle East Peace Process." Sowell wrote this.
Now that Israel has responded to rocket attacks and the abduction of its soldiers by terrorists by making military strikes into areas controlled by those terrorists, much of our media are deploring another cycle of violence in the Middle East. For reasons unknown, some people seem to regard verbal equivalence as moral equivalence, and the latter as some kind of badge of broad-mindedness, if not intellectual superiority. Therefore, when Palestinian terrorists, militants in politically correct newspeak, attack Israel and then Israel responds with military force, that is just another cycle of violence in the Middle East to some people. The cycle notion suggests that each side is just responding to what the other side does. But just what had Israel done to set off these latest terrorist acts? It voluntarily pulled out of Gaza after evacuating its own settlers, and left the land to the Palestinian authorities. Terrorists then used the newly acquired land to launch rockets into Israel and then seized an Israeli soldier. Other terrorists in Lebanon followed suit. The great mantra of the past, trading land for peace, is now thoroughly discredited, or should be. But facts mean nothing to people who are determined to find equivalents, whether today in the Middle East or yesterday in the Cold War. Since all things are the same, except for the differences, and different except for the similarities, nothing is easier than to create verbal parallels and moral equivalents, though some people seem to pride themselves on their ability to do such verbal tricks. Centuries ago, Thomas Hobbes said words are wise men's counters, but they are the money of fools. Regardless of fashionable rhetoric, there is no Middle East peace process any more than trading land for peace has been a viable option. Nor is a Palestinian homeland a key to peace. During all the years when Arab countries controlled the land now proposed for a Palestinian homeland, there was no talk about any such homeland. Only after Israel took control of that territory as a result of the 1967 war was it suddenly sacred as a Palestinian homeland. There is no concession that will bring lasting peace to the Middle East because the terrorists and their supporters are not going to be satisfied by concessions. The only thing that will satisfy them is the destruction of Israel. Pending that, they will inflict as much destruction and bloodshed on the Israelis as they can get away with at any given time. This brutal reality is not going to vanish through verbal sleight of hand. The terrorists have spoken in words and in deeds, including suicide bombers. They have what Churchill once described in the Nazis as currents of hatred so intense as to sear the souls of those who swim upon them. We saw that on September 11th, or should have seen it. But many, especially among the intelligentsia, are determined not to see it. Of all the Western democracies, only two have no choice but to depend on their own military forces for their survival, the United States and Israel. The rest have, for more than half a century, had the luxury of depending on American military forces in general and the American nuclear deterrent in particular. People who have long been sheltered from mortal dangers can indulge themselves in the belief that there are no mortal dangers. Nuclear weapons in the hands of Iran or North Korea, and through them, in the hands of hate-filled terrorists, may be all that will finally wake up such people. But that may be tragically too late. Those who keep calling for an end to the cycle of violence are what make such violence more likely. World opinion in general and the United Nations in particular can always be counted on to counsel restraint in response to attacks and negotiations in response to lethal threats. What that means is that those who start trouble will have a lower price to pay than if those they attacked were free to go all out in their counterattack. Lowering the price to be paid by aggressors virtually guarantees more aggression.
In this column, Sowell makes two key points. Number one, the cycle of violence rhetoric is little more than a verbal sleight of hand designed to suggest moral equivalency between those who attack first and those who retaliate. Number two, there is no concession which the Israelis could make which would satisfy the Palestinians, because what the latter only really want is the destruction of the former. A second column, published in 2014, was called Cease the Ceasefires. Sowell wrote this.
Many years ago, on my first trip around the world, I was struck by how the children in the Middle East, Arab and Israeli alike, were among the nicest-looking little children I had seen anywhere. It was painful to think that they were going to grow up killing each other, but that is exactly what happened. It is understandable that today many people in many lands just want the fighting between the Israelis and the Palestinians to stop. Calls for a ceasefire are ringing out from the United Nations and from Washington, as well as from ordinary people in many places around the world. According to the New York Times, Secretary of State John Kerry is hoping for a ceasefire to open the door to Israeli and Palestinian negotiations for a long-term solution. President Obama has urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to have an immediate, unconditional humanitarian ceasefire, again with the idea of pursuing some long-lasting agreement. If this was the first outbreak of violence between the Palestinians and the Israelis, such hopes might make sense. But where have the UN, Kerry, and Obama been during all these decades of endlessly repeated Middle East carnage? The Middle East must lead the world in ceasefires. If ceasefires were the road to peace, the Middle East would easily be the most peaceful place on the planet. Ceasefire and negotiations are magic words to the international community. But just what do ceasefires actually accomplish? In the short run, they save some lives. But in the long run, they cost far more lives by lowering the cost of aggression. At one time, launching a military attack on another nation risked not only retaliation, but annihilation. When Carthage attacked Rome, that was the end of Carthage. But when Hamas or some other terrorist group launches an attack on Israel, they know in advance that whatever Israel does in response will be limited by calls for a ceasefire, backed by political and economic pressures from the United States. It is not at all clear what Israel's critics can rationally expect the Israelis to do when they are attacked. Suffer in silence, surrender, flee the Middle East, or, most unrealistic of all, fight a nice war with no civilian casualties. General William T. Sherman said it all 150 years ago. War is hell. If you want to minimize civilian casualties, then minimize the dangers of war by no longer coming to the rescue of those who start wars. Israel was attacked not only by vast numbers of rockets, but was also invaded, underground, by mazes of tunnels. There is something grotesque about people living thousands of miles away, in safety and comfort, loftily second-guessing and trying to micromanage what the Israelis are doing in a matter of life and death. Such self-indulgences are a danger, not simply to Israel, but to the whole Western world, for it betrays a lack of realism that shows in everything, from the current disastrous consequences of our policies in Egypt, Libya, and Iraq, to future catastrophes from a nuclear-armed Iran. Those who say that we can contain a nuclear Iran, as we contained a nuclear Soviet Union, are acting as if they are discussing abstract people in an abstract world. Whatever the Soviets were, they were not suicidal fanatics, ready to see their own cities destroyed in order to destroy ours. As for the ever-elusive solution to the Arab-Israeli conflicts in the Middle East, there's nothing faintly resembling a solution anywhere on the horizon. Nor is it hard to see why. Even if the Israelis were all saints, and sainthood is not common in any branch of the human race, the cold fact is that they are far more advanced than their neighbors, and groups that cannot tolerate even subordinate Christian minorities can hardly be expected to tolerate an independent and more advanced Jewish state that is a daily rebuke to their egos.
In this second column, Sowell makes two further points. Number one, that ceasefires are actually counterproductive because they lower the cost of aggression and just lead to more aggression in the future. Number two, that the West's reaction to Israel's retaliation has a grotesque quality which betrays our lack of realism about the Middle East. Of course, Sowell has written more than just these two columns about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but I think these two columns provide a solid foundation for understanding how Sowell views the dynamics at play there. Before I bring Dennis Prager onto the podcast, there's one more thing I want to share with you. We've heard the Israeli national anthem, Hatikva, and I've translated its lyrics into English. I think it would be only fair if I also introduce the Palestinian national anthem and translate its lyrics into English as well. Most of you probably didn't even know that there is a Palestinian anthem. I didn't know that until I began researching for this episode. Technically, Palestine isn't an official country, so you would think there would be no national anthem. But apparently, there is. It's called Fida'i, which means Fedayeen warrior. Here's the anthem, and I'll read the English translation while it's playing. Warrior, 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 O my land, the land of the ancestors, warrior, warrior, warrior. O my people, people of eternity. With my determination, my fire, and the volcano of my vendetta, with the longing in my blood for my land and my home, I have climbed the mountains and fought the wars. I have conquered the impossible and crossed the frontiers. With the resolve of the winds and the fire of the weapons and the determination of my nation in the land of struggle, Palestine is my home and the path of my triumph. Palestine is my vendetta and the land of withstanding. By the oath under the shade of the flag, by my land and nation and the fire of pain, I will live as a warrior. I will remain a warrior. I will die as a warrior until my country returns. At this time, I will offer no judgment or interpretation of the meaning behind this anthem. I will leave that to each of you to judge for yourself. Now it's time to bring Dennis Prager onto the podcast to discuss these issues with me. Dennis Prager was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1948. He graduated from Brooklyn College with a major in Middle Eastern Studies. In 1982, when he was 34 years old, Prager got his first big break as a radio talk show host at a local Los Angeles radio station. And over the years, his show was syndicated into other markets, and he is now known nationally as one of America's preeminent conservative talk show hosts. In 2009, he founded perhaps his greatest achievement yet, Prager University, also known as PragerU, which you can find online at PragerU.com. I highly encourage you to explore the offerings at PragerU.com. There are hundreds upon hundreds of extremely well-produced educational videos on a wide range of topics, oftentimes no longer than 5 minutes each. There's a section for adults and a section for kids. The videos cover current events, American and world history from a wholesome, positive, and uplifting perspective, and they are hosted by world-class scholars such as Victor Davis Hanson, Alan Dershowitz, Gad Saad, Wilfred Riley, Raphael Mengual, Jason Riley, and many, many more great thinkers, not to mention many videos by Dennis Prager himself. At the time of this podcast, PragerU has over 3 million subscribers on YouTube, and many of its videos have been watched over 10 million times each. And all these videos and programs are totally free. This is one of those rare cases where you get way more than you pay for. Dennis Prager's genius in creating PragerU lies, I believe, in this key insight, that the vast majority of people in our world do not get their ideas and their information from books. Most people simply do not read books, but they do watch videos. And what better way to educate the vast majority of people than to provide them with free, short-form videos on a wide variety of important topics, all from a conservative perspective. I have personally watched dozens and dozens of PragerU videos, and I plan on sharing all of them with our children over time. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome Dennis Prager to the show. Dennis Prager, welcome to the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
Well, I love the man, and I love that you're doing this.
Thank you for that. So tell us about your involvement with Sowell and with his work. Which books of his have you read? Which one or ones really stick out in your mind? And what place do you think Sowell occupies in America today?
So I'll begin on the personal note. I have had Tom Sowell on my radio show for I gotta believe decades. I remember when I think, I don't know if it was the first time I had him on, but I knew I could be over the top with him. And I had him on with regard to basic economics, you know, the 408th edition of the book, which I'm kidding, but it should, it's God willing, it will go into 408 editions. So I said to him, you know, Tom, I gotta level with you. The book is magnificent, which all his books are magnificent. But I gotta tell you, the title is not, it's not a major turn on, basic economics. I said, why didn't you title it something like Tom Sowell's Guide to Bikinis? And he cracked up. I knew then, this is my kind of guy, that he thought that was hilarious, was perfect. So it's always been a very warm relationship. My wife and I had dinner with him and his wife when he was in the LA area or where I live, and it's a total joy to be in his life and have him on the show or just meet with him privately. I have a lot of thoughts actually about him. I am a student of the human condition and have been all of my life. He, aside from being brilliant and clear, is courageous. And as I have said much of my life, there are many nice people, kind people, loyal people, good spouses, good friends, but there are very few courageous people. And all the good traits don't make a good world without courage. So one of the riddles of my life that I've tried to solve is, how do you account for courageous people since there are so few of them? And I don't have a great answer to this day. I think certain people are born courageous, which is a little disconcerting because I want to know how to make courageous people and not rely on fate or genetics or divine influence. That's just a fact. Some people just are born with courage. But I also do believe that if one resolves to be courageous, one can be. So it's not entirely a matter of fate. Whatever it is, whether he decided to be or that's part of his nature, you cannot explain or understand Tom Sowell if you don't understand the role that courage plays in his work. For anyone to say what he says, which is truth, truth-telling is the most courageous act almost anyone can engage in. We live in a world of lies. And for him to say many of these truths as a Black man adds to the courageous element, because a fair amount of what he says goes against what Black and white leftists, the people who dominate discourse about race, say, and which are just untruths. So I think it's important. I'm giving you a long answer to a short question, but before we came on, you invited me to do that. So here I am. Again, one cannot understand Tom Sowell without understanding the role that courage plays in his writing and speaking. They're asking what one's favorite Tom Sowell book. I'll give you a musical analogy since I'm very involved in classical music. I periodically conduct orchestras, for example. So you can't ask me what's my favorite Beethoven piece. it doesn't exist. There are 30 that are tied for first. I would say, in essence, all of Tom Sowell's books are tied for first. What he does, and this, that's why he is so important, because the lessons to be learned, not just about what he writes, but the fact that he writes them, the lessons are critical to a better society. The pursuit of truth is the issue, and it takes courage to pursue truth. The reason people lie is not because they like lying. It's because they don't have the courage to tell the truth. Affirmative action hurts blacks. That's a truth. It's not an opinion. It's not a feeling. I mean, I'm using one of his themes about affirmative action based on race, for example. The idea that we lower standards on your behalf is so demeaning to the recipient of that diminution. And Tom Sowell has, because he only knows how to pursue truth, he doesn't know anything else except pursuing truth. So he just says, it just hurts the recipients. I remember in the very beginning of affirmative action, I've been broadcasting 40 years, so it's a long time when I speak about what opinions I had in the beginning. And I remember saying, blacks deserve affirmative action, but it is bad for them. So deserve is not the same as benefit from. I deserve, I mean, it's not a poor analogy. It's not a perfect analogy. I think I, Dennis, do a fair amount of good things in life. I deserve the right to enjoy dessert. But dessert is not good for me. So I don't have desserts generally. The fact that one may deserve X doesn't mean X is good for them. So the essence of soul is truth telling. And the essence of the university and the whole left world, the left, not liberals, liberals are naive, but the left is rooted in lies. If the day you decide to pursue truth, you leave the left. You can be a liberal, you can be a conservative, but you can't be what is dominant, and that is left. Tom Sowell is the embodiment of courage because he is the embodiment of truth pursuit. Okay, I'll be shorter in the next one.
To respond to that, I've always thought that one of the reasons Tom Sowell can speak the truth is there's a famous clip where someone asks him, "Do you have peer approval?" And he says, "I don't know if I have peer approval." And the interviewer says, "Why not?" And Tom Sowell answers, "Because I don't care." And I think that is the essence of his courage, is that he cares more about truth than what anyone thinks about him.
So, well, here you're starting me again, because if you care, if you are motivated by what others will say about you, you will always compromise truth. You will compromise all good values. It's funny, when you told me, when you just stated that anecdote, I thought he was going to say, when he said, "Well, why not?" I thought his answer was going to be, "Because I have no peers." But I realized it would sound too conceited. But the truth is, he can't have peer assessment
approval.
Oh, was that the word you used?
Yeah.
Approval. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because the truth is, he has few peers. I mean, that's just I can say it. I guess he can't say it.
Well,
that's really important. Again, you either, again, it's back to truth. If you pursue truth, you may alienate a lot of people. As I'm a religious individual, and I have often said, I've written 4 volumes of my 5-volume Bible commentary on the first 5 books of the Bible, the Torah, the Rational Bible. And in it, I note that we are supposed to fear God. In fact, wisdom begins with the fear of God. It says, not in the 5 books, but later on in the Old Testament. And as I put it, you either fear God or you fear man. And if you fear man, you will compromise, period.
One of Sowell's most important concepts, I feel, is the concept of a tragic vision of human nature, that we're all flawed and that it's only going to get so good when you're dealing with human beings, and that you have to make compromises. There have to be trade-offs. Sowell contrasts this vision with a more utopian vision of human nature, which is that if we just arrange society in just the right way, everybody will be good, everybody will behave, everything will be great. What are your thoughts about this concept? And what, if anything, does Judaism teach us about this dichotomy?
Anyone who thinks human nature is basically good is a fool. And I've annoyed a lot of people, indeed probably alienated a fair number in saying that. This is why, I mean, you're really hitting all my key concepts here, and that's why I'm so in sync with Tom Sowell. Rousseau's notion of the noble savage, that, you know, we're really basically good, society screws us up, is the origin. There's no religion on earth that begins with the notion that people are basically good. Certainly not Judaism, since you raised it. The will of man's heart is towards evil from his youth. It's one of the first statements the Torah makes about the human being. It's in Genesis, I think Genesis 8. Maybe Genesis 6, but early on in the Bible. The task in life is to channel your nature into goodness. And it's doable, but it's hard. How to make good people is the most important question in life. As I have said in about 1,000 speeches, I grew up with a very different mindset, having attended till I was 19 yeshiva, which is religious Jewish school, half the day in Hebrew, half the day in English. Very rigorous religious education. And I've often noted that I was raised to believe that the greatest problem in Dennis Prager's life is Dennis Prager. Whereas in secular school, you're taught greatest problem in life is society. It's racism, it's capitalism, it's patriarchy. You name the ill of society. The left doesn't teach you to battle your nature. It teaches you to battle America. And that's why America may not survive. You have to battle yourself every day of your life to be a good person. And you can become a good person, not a perfect person. So, of course, Sowell is right on that issue, and that's essential Judeo-Christian thinking. By Judeo-Christian, I'm talking about Judaism and Christianity share a Bible. It's called the Old Testament. No other two religions share a Bible. That's a big deal. Some Jews are uncomfortable with the term. Some Christians are uncomfortable with the term. I'm not guided by comfort. I'm guided by truth. When two religions share a Bible, it's fair to speak about their having a lot in common. So, yes, that's the issue. A rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, I was sorry to see, wrote a piece about a year and a half ago in an American Jewish publication saying human nature is basically good. I was so disgusted that an Orthodox rabbi could write that. Had a reformer conservative rabbi written it, it wouldn't have bothered me nearly as much. But once I see that idiocy is infecting the religious, the fundamentally religious community, I get worried. So I wrote a piece, my syndicated column that week, even though my syndicated column is read, 95% of the people who read it are not Jewish, but didn't matter. The issue is universal. And I said how sad I was, angry even, that an Orthodox rabbi could write such drivel. And I didn't even mention his name because I said I have no desire to humiliate him. I want to get rid of the idea, not the man. But anyway, he decided to write a rebuttal. I thought it was a stupid piece, but he wrote a rebuttal. And to my amazement, he agreed to debate me, and we did. We had a debate in Beverly Hills. It's on the internet. Your viewers and listeners should watch it.
I'll link to it in the show notes.
I'm sorry?
I'll link to it in the show notes.
Oh, great, great. How would you, in particular, after Auschwitz, or for that matter, after Hamas, their kindred spirits, the two forms of Nazism, I couldn't believe that people are basically good. Shows you most people, not Tom Sowell, hopefully not I, hopefully not you, but most people do, in fact, believe what they want to believe. People want to believe that human nature is basically good. It's an extremely dangerous and foolish idea.
Right now, there's a war going on in Israel, and in preparation for this podcast, I shared with you two columns Sowell had written about Israel's relationship with its neighbors. One was in 2006, and the other one was in 2014. In those two columns taken together, Sowell makes four major points, and I'd like to go through them one by one with you. Number one, Sowell claims that the phrase, a cycle of violence, is little more than a verbal trick to make it sound like each side is simply reacting to attacks by the other side. But according to Sowell, Israel is reacting to unjustified attacks and unprovoked attacks on its civilian population, and it's reacting with retaliation. Do you agree with that?
Cycle of violence is another reason that I have such contempt for the left. Almost everything they write is stupid. It's not just often just not true. It's just intellectually shallow. Cycle of violence. So let me understand. Was World War II not a cycle of violence? Germany bombed England. England bombed Germany. Germany bombed the Allies. The Allies bombed Germany. Japan bombed America. America bombed Japan. What war is not a cycle of violence? Anyone who thinks clearly understands that if there is a cycle of violence, which all war is, every single war is a cycle of violence, every police action is. A guy shoots up a school and the police come and shoot him. It's a cycle of violence. I mean, right? He started, and then the cycle, they killed him, and then he shot them back until somebody won, hopefully the good guys. It's a denial of there being good guys. Cycle of violence renders morality anodyne. It's pasteurized. It's homogenized. That's it. Homogenized, not really pasteurized. Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, there's no bad and good. There's just the side. That's what the left is saying, which is what they do say.
It's just the Hatfields and the McCoys, basically, is what they're saying.
That's right. That's all it is. Right. Exactly right. And needless to say, Tom hit it out of the ballpark.
The second point that Sowell makes in those columns is he says that trading land for peace is an illusion, because there are no concessions which would satisfy Israel's opponents. because the only thing that would really satisfy them is the destruction of Israel. Now, if this is really true, then there's no point to any ceasefires without one side surrendering, because there's nothing to negotiate about. What are your thoughts on this very, very powerful argument?
About 10 years ago, I think it was the first video I made for PragerU. PragerU has, as of this broadcast, about 600 five-minute videos. And I only give 10%, one out of 10. The first one was the Middle East, explaining the Middle East. And it's probably the most widely viewed pro-Israel video ever made. It's tens of millions of views, which I'm delighted beyond words. By the way, it is literally more relevant and understandable today than it was 10 years ago. The theme was, which I repeat over and over, in the 5 minutes, it's only 5 minutes, one side wants the other side dead. And that's it. That's the Middle East dispute. I was a fellow at the Middle East Institute at Columbia University, School of International Affairs, where I did my graduate work. I did it in Middle Eastern studies and Soviet studies. So I studied Russian and Arabic, and I already knew Hebrew, so I took this stuff very seriously. And all of my professors, or better, none of my professors in the Middle East Institute acknowledged that that was the issue. One side wants the other side dead. Well, they claimed the land, and they claimed the land. It was like at the Russian Institute, the other institute I was a fellow at, it was, it's two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. It wasn't freedom versus tyranny. It was superpower versus superpower. The left, and that means virtually all of academia, undermines the moral battles of the world. So that the battle in the Middle East was over land. They never even acknowledged it was a primarily religious issue, that religious Muslims didn't believe that the Jews should have 10 square feet of land in the Middle East. One side wants the other side dead. Once again, Tom Sowell understands this better than 99% of the professors of Middle Eastern history.
The third point that Sowell makes is that fire actually counterproductive as they lower the cost of aggression and just lead to more and more aggression in the future. He gives the analogy as when Carthage attacked Rome back in the olden days, that was the end of Carthage. And he's suggesting that that is a proper way to resolve these disputes. When one side attacks another, annihilation should be on the table. Total annihilation should be an option for the party being attacked. What do you think about this?
Well, I don't know if he meant, I read that, and I don't know if he meant total annihilation as you wipe out every single member of that group. I wouldn't be for that. I suspect that Tom Sowell is not advocating that. But you annihilate their ability to fight again. When I look back, I was a kid. But I do remember the Six-Day War. In fact, my first trip to Israel, I think I was 18, was to Israel within a month of the Six-Day War. And, you know, Israelis debated what to do with the West Bank. It was part of Jordan, and Jordan tragically entered the war because they believed Nasser, the Egyptian dictator, that they were destroying Israel, and if he wanted any of the booty, he should join the war, and he did. Israel begged him. They have the recordings. They begged King Hussein not to get involved. So he lost the West Bank, and there were three options, annex the West Bank, give it back to Jordan, or occupy it until such time as the Palestinians would actually agree to two states, one of them a Jewish state and one an Arab state. They opted for the third. That's, by the way, what I agreed with most of my life, two-state solution. I didn't want Israel to occupy anybody else for Jewish and democratic reasons. But I think I was naive. I didn't follow my own understanding of things. They don't want peace with Israel. They want peace without Israel. People do not understand that. Even I didn't. I'm embarrassed, actually, because it was should have been obvious. I mean, it became obvious. This is not something I just realized, you know, last week, but I didn't realize it as an 18-year-old in 1967.
Go ahead. No, you're good.
No. Okay. All I was going to say is what they should have done, maybe only God knows. But I did at least want to explicate for your viewers and listeners what the options for Israel were. And that this notion that Israel occupies and denies the two-state solution, well, they did abandon Gaza, and they got what you just saw, monsters, Nazis. They're indistinguishable morally from Nazis. They want to eliminate every Jew of Israel, like the Nazis wanted to murder every Jew, including babies, in Europe. I mean, if people don't understand that, it's because they don't want to understand that. There is no excuse after the 10/7 attacks. But I knew this, obviously, and many did before that. One side wants the other side dead. That was my video of 10 years ago, after all. I don't know what Israel should have done, but I do know it can't abandon the West Bank without committing suicide.
Even Sowell admits in his columns that he doesn't really know what the solution is, but he knows there's no easy solution. And we did have a president who thought he knew what the solution was, President Trump, and he created the Abraham Accords. I guess he started the ball rolling. And I guess he thought, I'd like to hear your opinion on this, but he thought that peace treaties between the Arab countries and Israel was the solution to the Mideast problem. And, you know, that's been derailed in many ways since Trump left office. But what are your thoughts? Is that the only solution, or does Israel have to move? Does Israel have to get out of, you know, they say there goes the neighborhood. Does Israel have to, you know, get out of the neighborhood for there ever to be a peaceful solution for Israel? Or is there another way?
The left, and not even just the left, the number of people who stop thinking rationally when the name Donald Trump comes up is very large. It's tragic. The human being, humans are ruled by emotions much more than by reason. That's an example. I mean, he did such good with the Abraham Accords and by moving the American embassy to the capital of Israel. So the question is, if enough Arab countries recognized Israel, would this in effect put pressure on the Palestinians to realize, you know what, we've even lost our own world. Maybe let's make a deal while we can. But I assume that was part of the thinking. And there's no question that the attack on Israel by Hamas was in part, since it was engineered by Iran, to undo any rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Israel. But the Saudis understand, as the Israelis do, that the great enemy of peace is Iran.
I remember Sowell, when he was speaking up about Iran, the danger of Iran getting nuclear weapons, he was really focused on that. And I think that was the reason he called Obama the worst president in American history. It was because he really has, through his Iran deal, he put America at grave risk. And I think Sowell has still, you know, clung to that idea many, you know, 12 years later.
Thank you.
The last major point Sowell makes in those two columns is that there's something grotesque about the reaction in the West to these outbreaks of violence in the Middle East. Sowell said this, I'm going to quote him, and I think he's talking about us when he says this. Quote, there is something grotesque about people living thousands of miles away in safety and comfort, loftily second-guessing and trying to micromanage what the Israelis are doing in a matter of life and death. Such self-indulgences are a danger, not simply to Israel, but to the whole Western world, for it betrays a lack of realism that shows in everything from the current disastrous consequences of our policies in Egypt, Libya, and Iraq, to future catastrophes with a nuclear-armed Iran. Do you think we suffer under a major lack of realism about the Middle East and the world in general here in America?
Well, it goes back to my phrase, people believe what they want to believe rather than what is true. They want to believe that, oh, if only Israel were more forthcoming, peace would reign in the Middle East. And there isn't a shred of evidence for that to be true. Not a shred. And by the way, I say this, and it's painful. I not only supported Oslo, the Oslo Accords, I remember when Yitzhak Rabin and Arafat shook hands, that I had tears in my eyes. I so yearned for peace and believed it was possible. And I believed it because I wanted to believe it. I knew Arafat's record. Arafat was a murderer. That is all he was. And a corrupt murderer. Some murderers are not corrupt. But he was both. Died a very wealthy man because he embezzled so much Palestinian funds. But I so wanted to believe that this would lead to peace that I did believe it. One side wants the other side dead. Tom Sowell understands this because it goes back to the beginning of our dialogue. The man pursues truth. He doesn't know how not to pursue truth. If Tom Sowell wrote about the Azerbaijan-Armenian dispute, I would assume whatever he wrote was accurate. It doesn't matter what he writes. That's why this notion, well, as I'm sure a leftist would say, what does Tom Sowell know about the Middle East? He has no degree in Middle East. By the way, if you have a degree in the Middle East, the odds are you're a dummy. I mean, that's the irony. I told you what my professors believe. They didn't believe religion was the animating aspect of the hatred of Israel, of the Jews there. And they believed that it was about land. And not the suppression of a Jewish state the size of New Jersey. There are 22 Arab states from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean, and there's no room for a Jewish state the size of New Jersey. That's a truism that if you're committed to truth, you need to acknowledge.
Let's shift gears here for a minute away from Israel. When I was preparing for this conversation, I took a look at PragerU.com. And I can honestly say it was the first time I had ever been to the website. Now, I've watched dozens and dozens of the videos, but I guess it was just randomly finding them on YouTube. And I went to the website, and I can honestly say I was really blown away by the depth and the breadth of the offerings there. I immediately ran to my wife and said, honey, we've got to start using this website for the kids because there's so much great educational material there. And I really want to encourage all my listeners to really subscribe to PragerU.com. Check it out. You could spend hundreds of hours learning in 5-minute or 10-minute or 15 or 20-minute chunks from that website. The book club is amazing. I mean, so many great things about it. So I'm really, really enthusiastic and excited about it. Tell my listeners what your mission is with PragerU. I mean, I think it's really... It's a baffling enterprise, and I think it's not that easy to understand exactly. So tell us what's the long-term goal here?
We pursue what all great education should pursue, truth, beauty, and goodness. That's it. In a nutshell, one young man years ago, before we had, I would say we had maybe 250 of our 600 five-minute videos up, and it was Bill Bennett's son. And he said, just want you to know, Dennis, I learned more at PragerU than at Princeton. which is true. There's no question. The only thing you can't learn at PragerU is STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. Of course, we don't teach that for good reason, but everything else we do teach. And we have some of the finest minds on earth teaching there. I'll give an example. We're doing a 5-minute video on every one of the presidents of the United States. Hmm. It is so relentlessly interesting. So I am one of the editors of every one of those videos. And just a few weeks ago, I edited the one on James Garfield, about whom, to be honest, I knew nothing. The 5 minutes got me so fascinated, I then bought a biography of James Garfield. You want to understand the Middle East? We have, I don't know, 20 maybe out of the 600 are on the Middle East. Bret Stephens of the New York Times and Alan Dershowitz of Harvard. And I have a couple, really first-class videos. There's one video on the six, either the five or six, I don't remember the number, offerings to the Palestinians of their own state, and they rejected them. How many Americans know that? Who's going to tell you that? The New York Times? Columbia University? Who's going to tell you that? They were offered a state 5 times and rejected it 5 times. And it's all there in 1 5-minute video.
Now, are you still experiencing, you've mentioned this before, a censorship of some of the videos or demonetization? What is that all about?
So it began with just dropping some from being promoted. I mean, our whole attempt is to promote these things so that we want to change minds. We don't only want to speak to those who agree with us. We think that's very important, to speak to those who agree with us. But we change minds, which is an amazing, over 1 billion views a year. The majority are under 35 years of age. That's Google has acknowledged that. So it began with literally just censoring, removing from Google, YouTube, Facebook, just removing videos and demonetizing others. So it's been a fight. I testified in the U.S. Senate about this. To his great credit, Senator Ted Cruz convened the session. And there was a representative of Google there, which owns YouTube. And they had taken down my video, in this case, it was a video I had made on the Ten Commandments. And I did 11 videos on the Ten Commandments, one on each commandment and an overview. So Ted Cruz looked at the guy from Google and said, "Why did you take down Mr. Prager's video on the sixth commandment?" And the guy with a straight face said, "Because it mentions murder." I mean, this is surreal. You could see it, by the way. It is actually, the whole session is on YouTube. You can watch it. So when it was my turn to speak, I said, "Senator, based on the gentleman's response, man from Google, we will now reissue a 9 commandments video." The attacks on us are surreal. It's so wholesome, Prager University. It's so sophisticated that the relentless attacks, you know, we teach white supremacy, we downplay slavery. Here's an example. Every single major media has attacked us in the last few months because Florida is allowing them to be used in classrooms. It's driving them crazy. So the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, CBS, NBC, all of them, everybody has attacked us. One of the most frequently cited examples of bad things that we issue, bad videos we put out, is, and they even put out a video, how to fold the American flag. Isn't that fascinating? They find it utterly repugnant, reprehensible, that we teach young people how to fold the American flag with respect and properly, because there is a procedure. That we would do that renders us fascist in the eyes of the entire left-wing media.
Okay, I have one final question for you, and this is something I've always wanted to ask you. You're a conservative. You're also Jewish. So many prominent Jews are liberals, and I've always wondered why that is. I mean, I understand why Jews start out liberal because of their history. They want to fight for what is just and what is right. But I don't understand why they remain liberals when they see that it's just not working out the way they had originally hoped. If any people should embrace Sowell's tragic vision of human nature, you would think it would be the Jews. Help us to understand this counterintuitive dynamic in the Jewish community.
In a nutshell, when Jews abandon belief that the Torah is from God, or at least the Ten Commandments, then they open themselves up to believing anything. There's a quote attributed to G.K. Chesterton, which he didn't actually make to the best of our knowledge, but it's I just cite it because I didn't come up with this brilliant quote. When people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. When Jews leave believing in Judaism as divine, they believe in anything. So for Jews, it's either Judaism or you name the ism, Marxism, socialism, environmentalism, feminism. That's what Jews, I always say, are the most religious people in the world. But for most of them, their religion is not Judaism. So in a nutshell, that's the reason. That's why Jews who do believe the Torah is ultimately from God, or at least the Ten Commandments, overwhelmingly are conservative and vote that way. That's very important for people to understand.
Dennis Prager, thank you for joining me on the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
It was a pleasure.
This has been episode 36 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. If you like this podcast and want to support the work we are doing, introducing more and more people to the ideas of Thomas Sowell, there are many ways you can help. Rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends about Sowell and the podcast. Support us on Patreon. Purchase our Thomas Sowell post-it notes. Follow me on Twitter for daily Sowell quotes and to connect with other fans of You Know Who. For now, just sit back and enjoy this orchestral version of Hatikvah performed by the Israel Philharmonic and conducted by Lahav Shani. At the end of this piece, I have a joke I'm dying to share with you, so hang in there until the end. You won't regret it. One day, the UN Secretary General proposes that, in the interest of global peace and harmony, the world's soccer players should come together and form one United Nations global soccer team. "Great idea," says his deputy. "But who would we play?" The Secretary General responds, "Why, Israel, of course." I'm Alan Wolin. Thanks for listening.